Hey, it's therapist and relationship coach Micah Ross, and this is the How to Talk About It podcast. Today on How to Talk About It, we are going to chat with Dr. Tia Dole about how to talk to teens about suicide. If you are a parent, this episode, in my opinion, is a must listen. In the United States, rates of suicide are on the rise, and more than 20% of all teens have seriously considered suicide. That means in a room of 100 teens, I know you can do math, 20 of them have been dangerously close to taking their own life. Today, Dr. Dole will tell us that it's important to consider demographics when we talk about statistics, and she shares some staggering ones regarding minority populations. But suicide is on the rise in all groups. According to the CDC, 30% of all teenage girls have seriously considered suicide. 13% make an attempt. More than 50% of adolescents with ADHD have suicidal thoughts. The statistics are staggering. Over the last few years, because I have teens and likely because my clientele has more teens, friends and clients are coming to me, usually unable to breathe, and telling me their kids have told them they have suicidal thoughts or are actively suicidal. Unfortunately, the statistics and my experience tell me this is an eventuality we as parents need to be prepared for. When I was a teen myself, I seriously contemplated suicide. I would stare at my wrists and wonder what it would be like. I even held something sharp against those dark blue veins on more than one occasion. I never told anyone. I wouldn't have dared. In my family, we had a very loud but unspoken rule that we do not talk about hard things. Let's just take puberty, for example. The extent of my sex talk was a book hidden amongst a series of books that was living in my room. It's like my mom wanted me to have the information, but didn't want to be the one to directly deliver it. If we don't talk about hard things as a rule in your house, it's usually not spoken. Kids just pick up on it when the adults shy away from uncomfortable topics over and over. On the day I learned about sex at school, my mom asked me enthusiastically at the dinner table, "So, what did you learn about at school today?" She wouldn't even say uncomfortable words like sex or vagina. I was well into elementary school when I realized that not every girl called her vulva or private parts a doobity. But I was now in the fifth grade, expected to talk about coitus and puberty over pork chops with my parents staring at me. I simply replied with I am not talking about this. And the subject was dropped like a 300-pound barbell that had barely made it off the ground, never to be picked up again. It's hard to break a rule that's been in place for years. In graduate school, I remember being trained to assess suicidality in clients. We were told this was something important to cover in every first session. Just the thought of asking the question, "Do you ever think about killing yourself?" was enough to make me fill with angst. Will asking this question make people want to kill themselves? What if they hadn't thought about it, but now they are? I was terrified to ask. I literally shook the first time I had to spit it out in a session as a counselor in training. If trained therapists can barely spit out the question, as parents, should we be expecting ourselves to talk about suicide with our kids? Is it really necessary? And if so, how? Should I leave this up to the professionals? Will it make a difference? I'm therapist and relationship coach Micah Ross, and today's episode of How to Talk About It is near and dear to my heart, and will answer all of those questions and more. Okay, so today we are talking about something that I feel is super important, but also super hard to talk about. Suicide, not just suicide, but suicide in teens and how to talk to our teens about suicide. And today I have with us, I'm so excited about this, I saw her on the CBS Sunday Morning Show a few weeks ago, and I was like, that's the person I need to help us tease this out. 988 is a suicide and crisis lifeline, if you don't already know. They offer 24/7 call, text, and chat access to trained crisis counselors who can help people experiencing suicidal substance use and or mental health crisis or any other kind of emotional distress. People can also call, text, or chat 988 if they are worried about a loved one. I don't think I realized that part.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So 988 is a direct connection to immediate support and resources for anyone that's in crisis. And I want to say a little bit about your background. There's a lot to say. I picked some key things because I want people to know why we should be listening to you. But Dr. Dole is a licensed clinical psychologist and a longtime advocate for the rights of those with intersectional identities and a history of leadership in other suicide prevention organizations. She has degrees in developmental psychopathology from Columbia University and has studied forensics in Switzerland and has a doctorate from Fordham University. She's a published author, and her passions include normalizing mental health conditions, especially in communities of color, LGBTQ communities, and helping people get access to services. And she is joining us all the way from New Jersey.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited. I told my husband, there's something in my Myers-Briggs personality type inventory that confirms this, that I don't tend to get very starstruck, you know, by famous people, but people who have been on the Sunday morning show.
I think that just means you're a nerd. Yeah. That's what that means.
I think you've hit the nail on the head.
Yes.
First off, I am wondering, is there anything personal about this topic for you? How did you get interested in and or become a leader in this space?
It was interesting because I actually started my career, you know, I was a school teacher and then I went back to school and got my degree. And I started out in early psychosis, which seems like a, you know, what does that have to do with suicide? Actually, young people who are having their first break have up to 50% chance of making a suicide attempt during the first 12 months of breaking, right? And so what happened was I ended up with
Can you define that for us real quick?
Yeah.
What is that break? What is that?
Well, you know, it's when folks are experiencing the first episodes of psychosis. So hearing voices, being delusional, unusual beliefs, and that conversion from losing touch with reality, which for boys, right, tends to be a little bit younger. It's like 6 to 18, and girls can be a little bit older. That conversion and losing touch really cause a lot of disruption. A lot of young people, especially if they're still in high school, can't finish high school. Anyway, I had a caseload of a bunch of young people who were incredibly suicidal. And in particular, I was working in Yonkers, which is just north of New York City. And it's officially a suburb or a small city that is incredibly diverse. And so, you know, and I've always, my whole career, even when I was going through my training, I always worked in diverse settings. And just sort of anecdotally, I was working with half of my caseload was actively suicidal. And then when I got this caseload, I said, oh my goodness, I need extra training on CBT for suicide prevention. Fairly intense. But what it did was it taught me how to sit in the uncertainty of someone who is thinking of ending their life. I do believe that I have a fairly high risk tolerance. If you're going to work with people who are suicidal, you can't hospitalize them every week. You can't hospitalize someone who is chronically suicidal every time they tell you they're suicidal. And so it's about establishing the trust, helping folks think about other options besides ending your life. And so that's how I started. And then it just kind of continued on from there, mostly because people would be like, oh, Tia can take these folks. She seems to be comfortable with this because a lot of clinicians do avoid people who are actively suicidal. It's very scary. It's high risk. And there are additional steps that might happen after you have a session. And so it's not for everybody, right? Everybody has a thing that they're good at. I'm not very good at helping people with eating disorders, right?
Sure.
And so I think everybody knows what their wheelhouse is over time. And for some reason, suicidal folks ended up mine.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you saw a huge need in adolescence.
Oh, yeah.
Was that unexpected? Like when you say half your caseload seemed to be actively suicidal.
I love working with young people. And the reason for that is because you can make really fast changes. If you're working with 6-year-old, 50-year-old, I'm old. You know, people are really slow to shift. But there is a world where if you have the right intervention with an 18-year-old person, you can change the trajectory of their life in 10 sessions, literally. And so it's just a really fast way and incredibly rewarding. And I think on top of it, you know, I just think that young people are interesting. I love how they think. I love how they're creative and they're not sort of bound by so many societal norms, although I think it's harder now than 20 years ago when I started. And I think being a young person now is really hard, harder than when I grew up in the 80s, where I was simply roller skating every day after school.
Why aren't they roller skating anymore?
I know, they're sitting on the computer.
It's so upsetting to me. So we're going to get into, I'm going to ask some questions about how parents can talk to their kids about suicidality, suicidal thoughts. But I think I want to say first, I have some near and dear people to me who have lost kids to suicide. I have some near and dear clients to me who have lost important people to suicide. What I don't want them to do with this information is to beat themselves up or blame themselves even more. I think it's really easy to do all of that when we lose somebody that we know to suicide, to ask ourselves questions like, should I have done more or should I have said something differently?
Well, I think what's interesting about that is folks who are suicidal, especially folks who have been thinking about suicidal, are very good at hiding it. It's like a skill, right? You know that this thing is going to be activating. Let's say there are two groups of suicidal folks. One group are people who have had contact with the mental health system, who have shared in the past to a clinician or to a teacher, whatever, I'm thinking about suicide, and have had bad experiences.
Yeah.
No, ending up in the ER when you're suicidal is a really challenging experience, primarily because there may not be beds. You may have a trainee who is well-intentioned but not well-trained yet. And you may have on the inpatient unit, which is a very unexpected, unpleasant experience most of the time, unless you're wealthy, in which case you can go to a private hospital, right? And so you have that group of people who have learned.
Yes.
Keep it to yourself. And then you have another group of people who maybe have never seen a clinician, but have been keeping these thoughts to themselves because of lots of reasons, right? Because of culture, thinking about suicide or even thinking about it, talking about it is against my religious beliefs. There are lots of reasons why people don't share, but a lot of it is around fear and judgment, the stigma around suicide. And so I think most people fall into these camps. And of course, you have folks who are actively suicidal and talk about it a lot. That's the third one.
Yeah.
I would say those three.
Well, and it seems like it's such a taboo topic. And I looked up the definition of taboo before we got on here, and it said intensely restricted.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's something we're intensely restricted about. And so I don't know how, as a society or as a people, we are supposed to know how to deal with something when even mentioning it feels so wrong.
Well, you know what it is, you know, obviously we're a Judeo-Christian culture, and how we understand giving away the gift, let's say, if you believe in God, that God has given you, and, you know, the impact, the cascading impact of a suicide in a family is sort of immeasurable, right? You instantly increase, like if you're a parent and you die by suicide, you instantly increase the chances of your children dying by suicide. There's so much rage, right? Some family members feel so much anger towards other family members who have died. There is guilt. It is so emotionally laden. The prospect of suicide and the fact of suicide, in some ways we say to ourselves, okay, if we pretend like it's not there, maybe it will go away. I think that during COVID, there was a shift where all of us were sitting at home. All of us lucky ones were sitting at home because there were people who were out in the world risking their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can see your kids drowning. My kids were going, I'm in a meeting. They're next to me doing algebra and I'm going off camera to solve a problem. I'm in this new math that I don't know how to do because it's unnecessarily hard. And these kids are drowning, right? And I think that there was something that happened during COVID that so many people experienced their people in their life having mental health problems, I'm putting it your quote up, or having depression or anxiety, who had never felt that, or even they themselves. And so in some ways, you know, you were saying a few minutes ago, there is such a stigma, but I do sense a loosening of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I now hear people say, I'm going to take a mental health day. Would never have said that 3-4 years ago.
Sure.
Or I hear parents say, you know, my kid's really struggling with anxiety. That's not something that I heard in casual conversation before. So
there is
a softening around that rigidity, which is you don't share information about yourself from a mental health perspective. And, you know, I think that that is helpful at the very least.
Totally. So during the pandemic, we lost one of our good family friends, their 16-year-old, very beginning of the pandemic, died by suicide. My cousin, when I was in my early 20s, died by suicide, and he wasn't the picture of suicide that I had in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
That was other people do those types of things or these types of people, and he didn't fit into that box.
mm-hmm. for me. I was not yet in graduate school or, you know, pursuing any type of career or training in mental health at the time. But I think it really opened my eyes to that this probably impacts more people than I know about.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even you think about the way that we track deaths, there's no central place where we say, this is the way that folks in this country have died, right? And then you think about people dying in small towns where the death can be inconclusive. The coroner is going to do the family a favor and say that it's not put it suicide. I think, and then also the suicide deaths that are with substance use or overdose, you can't really track intention. And most people don't receive a postmortem in terms of like, what was their intention here? And so 2022, about 50,000 people die by suicide. And I always add in my mind that we know of, there is a suicidal crisis happening, but concurrently, there is more conversation around mental health. And that excites me. That excites me.
Yeah. Okay. What are the statistics on adolescents who are seriously contemplating suicide or have seriously contemplated suicide? And do you estimate that those are higher than?
The best way to do those statistics is demographically, right? Mm-hmm. And so let's say you have an LGBTQ youth. I always like using this because it's my population I like to work with, right? Yep. Between 40 and 50% of them can seriously consider suicide. It's a statistic from Trevor Project, right? They do a national survey with 23,000 people, seriously consider suicide in the last year. And if you add in an intersectional identity, like also being trans or being a person of color, you're going to increase that risk. And then, you know, one of the more troubling statistics is around Black youth and younger people, not necessarily teenagers. We're finding the most recent studies have come out that said Black boys under the age of 12 are the most likely to die by suicide.
Oh, under the age of 12.
And the interesting thing about, interesting in a horrible way, is that for, you know, Black folks in general, what we're finding is that the measures that we use to detect depression and anxiety are not pinging them, right? They're not showing up depressed because the measures are not made for them, right? There's a different background. And so what the research says is Black people are more likely to die by suicide with no notice, right? There's no indication. And really, to me, it is actually because the tools that we're using are not made for them. Staying on this whole demographic idea, 10, 15 years ago, Black communities were protected from suicide. Mm-hmm. There was this idea that folks were more religious.
Right. That this was like, what I remember learning in graduate school.
Yeah, sure. It's not true anymore. So that difference is completely gone. And if you look at the CDC statistics, you can see every group has gone up and no group more than folks of color and LGBTQ folks. And so everybody's caught up, ultimately speaking. And of course, still today, statistically, the group that's most likely to die by suicide are middle-aged white men, primarily because they use guns and are more likely to complete. And so, you know, I think, what does this mean societally? People ask me about this all the time. You know, is 988, for instance, going to end suicide? Nope. But there is a huge investment along the crisis continuum. So 988, you know, if you don't mind me talking about it, is like we're a service, right? We're a national service. The last fiscal year, we served 5 million people.
Yeah.
The year before, we served 3 million, right? So that's a huge jump. And it's not so much that people are more suicidal, which they are, but it's really about people knowing about us. Less than 17% of the U.S. population even know that 988 exists. So we're working on that.
Yeah.
But we're a stop in the crisis continuum. And you think about what comes before us and what comes after us. Usually what comes after us are, let's say, a crisis stabilization unit, potentially like a three-day, not real hospitalization where a person can stabilize. You have a mobile crisis team, you have inpatient unit, then you have outpatient unit. What comes before us are schools, detecting outpatient clinics, private clinicians. In some ways, we are a stop. We're not necessarily even the most important stop, but we are probably the biggest connector along the continuum. And because of that, it's an interesting position to be in because we want more people to use us. And, you know, my biggest worry is that we might be running out of resources to refer people to. So we talk them down And then we say, okay, here's a local clinic. Does the clinic have a room? Is it space? And, you know, not for nothing, I know a lot of just regular old folks who have tried to find a clinician for their teenager. And good luck, right? It is really, that people don't take insurance. It is wildly expensive. The insurance may not have out-of-network benefits. And most people can't pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month for an intervention, right? And then you have a psychiatrist to see if you need medication. Paying $300 for 15 minutes just doesn't seem tenable for most families. Yeah. That sounds negative. I see states investing, right? Each state makes a decision about what they want to invest in. Most states are saying, okay, the federal government believes in 98. I do think it was like the catalyst. We're going to invest in this. Incredible. So now we have to invest in the crisis continuum so that we can serve people afterwards.
Once 988 is called, it sounds like it's an incredible intervention, but then getting people the care that they need is complex. I heard you say, you know, 12-year-old boys. Like, I don't know that a lot of parents think to even broach this subject with kids. Oh, yeah. Hey, listener, it's Micah. A week after the podcast was recorded, realizing that a small bit of our conversation did not record. And I'm going to do my best to summarize. I say to Dr. Dole, it sounds like detecting suicidality is important and that schools, teachers, and mental health professionals are imperative in detection. And then we start talking about a parent's role.
Parents are not comfortable asking about suicide because that's a lot to ask, especially since clinicians don't want to ask about suicide. Yeah. What you can say is like, hey, I noticed something. I think the most dangerous thing that parents say to each other is, hey, I noticed my daughter's doing this thing. What do you think? Oh, this is hormonal. Oh, she's 16. That's normal, right? Any behavior change that you're seeing in your child, you are the expert on your child. Mm-hmm. You see something, ask. But ask, and it's an interesting thing because kids, I find, open up in the car when you're driving or when you're doing a concurrent activity. So let's say, hey, knock, knock, knock. Is everything going on in there, like on their computer? I don't know if that tends to not work out, but let's say we're going to go and do something and I'm making you help me garden and we're doing something that is keeping our attention. Then I can say, you know, I noticed recently that you just didn't seem okay. What's happening? And they say, well, I've been feeling like hopeless about the future or whatever. Hearing words like hopeless, you know, stressed, or I just don't enjoy the things that I, you know, all these kind of are clues to say, do you ever think about ending your life, right? You can ask the ways, you know, there is a way. I ask my kids.
Yep, me too.
And kids are often suicidal. It's not necessarily cause for alarm. I get texts from people all the time. They're like, my kid just said they were suicidal. I'm always like, it's very normal. And you can ask a little bit more questions, like what is happening? Usually, there's a million reasons why young people are suicidal. Sometimes it's that test that feels insurmountable and suicide feels like an option. Sometimes it's being bullied. Sometimes I am queer, right? I know I'm gay and I'm in a deeply religious family and I'm terrified that I'm going to be found out. I always say that there is, even if it's the same reason, I'm gay, this other kid says I'm gay, the feelings behind it are unique.
Totally.
Each person's suicidal thoughts are as unique as a snowflake, ultimately speaking. And so being calm, and it's not the word, I wouldn't use the word curious. I guess I would use the word, especially as a parent, is just keeping it cool. Mm-hmm. And just being as non-defensive as possible. Because what happens when a young person is suicidal, the parent starts to spiral around what they have done.
Yes.
How did I not notice? Am I exerting too much pressure? You might be. You know, what are like the list of things? That's one group of parents. I'm a group person today, apparently. Mm-hmm. And the other group of parents is, you know, they're going to be in denial about it. No, you're not. Parents do say that.
Yes.
You're not suicidal. You're not upset. You're not anxious. You're just X. And whatever the X is more acceptable to me.
Cue the shutdown of the child.
Good luck trying to get information after you say that.
Sure. I hear you saying words like normalize or destigmatize. How important is that? What is that about?
You know what it is young people today are really concerned about standing out in a way that they haven't chosen. So, you know, if you think about what social media is all about getting likes, right? About people noticing you, but noticing you in the way that you have selected them to notice. So they're going to notice my new hair. They're going to notice whatever I've done to myself. And there is nothing worse for most young people than to stand out in a way that makes them different in a bad way.
Yes.
And so, you know, people ask me not infrequently, do you think that social media is helpful? I think it's terrible.
Yeah.
But like, it's helpful. It is helpful for folks who have certain identities and they're incredibly isolated. So you go online, you can find your community, and that's fantastic. However, the social comparison that happens in social media,
yes,
personal opinion, that is the cause of at least 25 to 30% of why young people feel terrible now.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, that's my personal opinion, right? And that's not like
yeah, totally. No, I know. It is interesting to think about the difference between how we grew up and, you know, what our kids are being subjected to on a minute-to-minute basis if they're online, you know, and the feelings. I mean, I've had teen clients say things to me, and I don't work with teens very, very often, but say things to me like, I can't walk the dog in the day. What if somebody takes a picture of me and posts it on social media and says, ooh, there she is? And it's like, I only had to think about the people who were right in front of me. I never had to think about being blasted all over the world wide web at that age.
Well, in, you know, there are lots of comedians talk about this, and I will use one comedian who I won't name because he's on the outs. There is something too about for young people, again, anecdotal, not based on research, the inability to be alone with your thoughts. Mm-hmm. That the internet and social media has robbed us all of, right?
Yeah.
How, you know, anytime you are waiting in line, your phone is out. You as an adult, you as a young person, there is an inability just to be a person in quiet. And I think that those moments create self-regulation, allow for decompression, and nobody has them anymore. You're constantly stimulated by a screen of some sort, your cell phone, your watch. And without those moments of quiet, I think we're just in a constant state of activation.
Yeah. And it sounds like from your perspective, it's keeping people from the practice of regulating themselves.
Yeah. There's something that has shifted societally, and this is not necessarily a topic of today's conversation, where because we can't sit in silence, because we don't know how to be, our kids don't know how to be either.
Yeah. The things that I've heard so far that it sounds like you suggest are, it sounds like being able to ask directly if we're getting the sense that our kids are hopeless or sad or stressed. It's important to be able to ask, have you thought about suicide?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you can, I don't want to put pressure on people. I think you can start. That's like an advanced move. If you can start with, I noticed something different about you. And without feeding words, I noticed something different. Are you feeling different than you normally do? Oftentimes people use the word anxiety. Anxiety is the easiest thing to admit to be.
Sure.
Because anxiety in our society is not necessarily a negative thing because it increases productivity in most people.
To a point.
It increases. I always joke to folks when I'm hiring people, I was like, I always hire anxious people because they get stuff done. That's 100% true, but there's a cost to them. So anxiety has become, from my perspective, a catch-all phrase for too many emotions that actually are more nuanced than that. So it can feel like anxiety. And I, even with my clients, I'll be like, well, you know, you're saying you're anxious, but I'm hearing sadness.
Yeah.
What is that feeling? Is it in your body? And so I think for parents who are sort of jumping into or thinking about engaging their children to speak about their emotions, start just by asking a question, which is, I see you. I see something different. Tell me.
Mm-hmm. I think that communicates non-verbally that I want to talk about things, even if they're hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my son is a freshman, and it was really, I mean, I know that my kids have these skills because they live with me and they've been modeled, which is lovely. But we were talking about his experience at school. He lost a lot of friends to private school around here. You know, so he's navigating high school and making new friends. And I was asking him about it. And he stopped and checked out with me. He said, I feel like you just want to hear that this is all sunshine, rainbows, and unicorns.
Yep.
And I said, wow, like, thank you for checking that out.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I want to hear if it's shit. You know, I am really asking how you're doing. I don't need it to be any way. I think what you're navigating right now is hard.
Yeah.
So I want to know. And it's fascinating to me. You know, I have a question here to ask you, like, what would you tell people to be doing when your kids are five? But it sounds like what you're saying is to just be open to talking about their feelings and to be paraphrasing, you know, what negative emotions you might be noticing with some curiosity.
Well, and it occurred to me while you were speaking is that parenting now is a whole different type of parenting than 20 years
so
ago.
It feels like a full contact sport sometimes.
I, you know, and in part because 20 years ago, right, 30 years ago, when I was being parented, you know, my mom didn't really have to show up to things.
No.
You know, when I applied to college, I just put things in front of her. I said, sign this.
Yes.
It was like a contact-free sport that the parent, it was just a very different. Now parents are working most of the time, right? They're working full time. Mm-hmm. They're coming back. There's no more real intergenerational living. So there's no grandma down the block.
I want that so badly.
Right? And then you're rushing home after an intense commute. And then, you know, you don't want Dr. Tia telling you, okay, now you need to sit down and talk to your kid. So I'll start out by saying to parents, how are you doing? Can you find a moment to yourself where you're not trying to be something else or take care of someone else?
Yep.
Right? And so, like, it's really hard to try to get your kid to do something that you can't do yourself.
Yeah. So to sit with your own feelings or to be conscious of the fact that you might need some space or some rest or time to de-stress.
So when I take the train in New York City, for safety reasons too, but I keep my phone in my pocket and I try not to touch anything, like I'm a germaphobe, but I stand there and I just look around. I try to find moments where I'm not engaged with anything but my own thoughts and observations. And, you know, if a parent can figure out, you think about what your day is today and what it's going to look like when the kids come home from school and you finish fixing dinner and you yelled at them to do their homework. And then you, by the time they are tucked into bed, and then when that 16-year-old knocks at 10 o'clock and says, can we talk? Which is what happens because they're up.
Yes.
I'm in bed.
Yes. I told you before we started that my husband and I actually in adolescence have reinstituted the kind of morning parent, nighttime parent that we had going on when they were tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many nighttime needs with these adolescents that we did not fully expect the need for, you know, sometimes a 1 a.m. conversation. You know, that's when they're ready and willing to open up.
Yeah.
It's been an interesting ride.
Right. But the idea of being on call like that, that is new.
Yes.
That is new. And there are times where you can set a boundary.
Totally.
Where you, I mean, like, you know, I know, you know, I used to always tell parents, like, if your kid's ready to talk, you got to talk. However, you are also a person and you have to be like, I hear and I see, I need a minute. Because
this feels important and I can't keep my eyes open.
Mm-hmm.
Can we do this tomorrow?
Yeah. Let's go out for a coffee. 3 o'clock? Because what you're doing is also modeling, setting boundaries for them.
Totally.
You are on call, but you're not, right?
Yes.
Especially as they get older, you can teach them to delay. 10-year-old, very different. They can't wait.
Sure.
They can't hold on to it. 17? Yeah, they can. Unless it's an emergency, they can't actually hold on to it. I think we are closer to our kids than we ever have been. And it is very intense. And I do see that young people are not happy. You know, there was a study that came out of, I think it was the CDC, where they did a study of girls in college age. 40% of them are intensely anxious or depressed. I mean, that's like nearly half of all students in college.
Yes.
And, you know, I was reading that and then I thought about the Surgeon General published something last year on loneliness. I don't know if you saw that it was.
Yes.
Which it didn't make a lot of, it, like it had a little bit of press and then it moved on. But I thought it was, out of the U.S. government, one of the most meaningful pieces of work.
Same. Same.
Okay. So that epidemic of loneliness, right?
And yes.
And there is this weird dynamic of our kids are super close to us and they are incredibly lonely. Mm-hmm. Both things, the solution for that is not a one size fits all. I think it really depends on the family.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the loneliness epidemic, I think, is one of the big reasons I started this. I feel like it's a lot of things sort of coming together at once. And I want to be mindful of your time. I have one more question that I want to ask. But I find I work with a lot of couples, probably 2/3-ish of my practice is couples and somewhere around 1/3-ish is individuals. But the amount of people who are lonely, who are also in close proximity to people quite often, is staggering. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but wonder if it's our inability to talk about hard things mm-hmm. that gets in the way of that emotional intimacy and has people feeling lonely despite being in close proximity to people.
Yes. And I'll say, I think that it is also the degree of hard things. So, you know, we are inundated with disasters, wars, sure. right? In a way that you just saw at 6 o'clock on the Sunday, so the, you know, on the daily news when you were watching, I don't know, Tom Brokaw, whoever you watched. And now it's like, I get alerts several times a day for things I don't think are necessarily news with all the terrible things that are happening. And so I think young people have told us not only are they lonely, but they don't have a feeling of hope for the future. And, you know, think about this. There were a bunch of storms this week. There's these weird earthquakes and natural disasters because of the way that we're ruining the earth. And, you know, they're not for nothing. They're like, what is it going to look like? Are we going to need to carry our own air tanks in 30 years?
Yes. And they have just so much of that that doom and gloom coming at them from all angles.
That's right.
All the time that we just didn't in a way when we were kids. Mm-hmm. It's overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you said something. Do we want our kids to know that having suicidal thoughts is normal?
The word that I landed on is common.
Okay.
So it is normal, but it's also incredibly painful, right? And so yeah. It's sort of like when you go to the GYN appointment or whatever, and they're like, this doesn't hurt. Yes, it does. It does hurt. Don't tell me it doesn't hurt. I can feel that. It's a weird analogy, but like just because things are typical and common doesn't make feel okay. But we want to also make sure that people know that actually about half of these kids here feel the same way as you. They're just not saying it aloud. Or, you know, 20%, like I've done this, like I've been in a room of 100 people and I'll say 20 of you have thought about suicide today.
Today.
That's what the stats tell us.
Wow.
I can see people's faces when I give talks like that. And I can see, I said, you're not alone. You're not alone.
Yeah.
So the idea that they think about young people, they don't want to be the only one. Mm-hmm. So it is so super common.
And I also want you to talk about for a minute, because it sounded like earlier you were saying that you feel like there's a distance between having a suicidal thought and being actively suicidal, that you think that most people underestimate that distance.
That the distance, though, can shrink at the moment. So you can't count on it, right? It really is. That's why you start the conversation so that you know where you are on the continuum.
You also said something in the CBS Sunday Morning interview where I think it was a statistic about if a young person talks to a supportive adult, it decreases their suicidality.
Yeah. So that was for that. They cut me off. It was a LGBTQ young adult. It decreases their risk of suicide by like I don't know, even remember what it was. It was like, it's between 40 and 50%. So like you talk to an adult who says, I accept who your identity for LGBTQ youth, you just saved your life. So it's not about coming to young people with solutions. It's acceptance.
I love it. That's exactly what I want. That feels, yeah. And I think that most people, when they walk into these tough conversations, believe that they have to be equipped with the solution. And I think our role is probably much smaller than that. It's small, but it's fun to just create the space and have some acceptance for what they're feeling.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I just loved talking to you. I thank you so much. I think this is, like I said to you in emails back and forth, I know that a lot of people need to hear this. So I'm happy to help get the word out. And thank you for making this possible for me.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great day.
Yes. Thank you. Hey, it's Micah. I just love Dr. Tia. And I want to say a little bit more here. What do I want my kids to know about this subject? I want my kids to know that suicidal thoughts are common. And that if you have them, it does not mean that you are irreparably broken, doomed, or that there is something wrong with you. It means that something needs to change. Maybe it's your environment. Maybe it indicates a need for tools and skills or for more supports in place. Maybe it means we need to talk to a doctor, have some blood work done. Maybe it means we should consider medication, find a tutor, do a little social scaffolding, hire a coach, or find a therapist. If my kids have suicidal thoughts, I hope they feel safe enough to tell me. But I understand if they don't. And I believe creating a plan for who they could reach out to is a proactive conversation that is worth having. 988 seems to be a great resource for this. Dr. Dole, being the well-trained mental health professional that she is, didn't give us a clear what we should do. As trained therapists, we're not supposed to should on people. We're supposed to help you find your own answers. We're supposed to meet you where you are. I'll dare to be a little bit more clear. I don't think we can keep not talking about it. Destigmatizing suicide, suicidal thoughts, and mental health issues seem so important in identifying people early in the continuum, especially teens. I doubt there's a parent out there who's lost a teen to suicide who regrets having this really hard conversation. But I guarantee you, there are people out there who have lost a child to suicide who desperately wish they could turn back time and have this hard talk. I want to tell a couple of stories that might be helpful and give some resources. First, I want to dispel a major myth. I think people worry that bringing up suicide will give people the idea or will increase risk. This is a major myth. Creating space for people to share fears, worries, and feelings makes all of those things more likely to diminish. When I was in graduate school, my supervisor noticed while watching my video recorded sessions that I was avoiding tough feelings with my clients and like dragging them back up to the surface or to more positivity. She challenged me in my next session to only paraphrase. That's like all I was allowed to do. I wasn't allowed to try to fix it. I wasn't allowed to try to put a positive spin on it. And the thought of doing this made me wildly uncomfortable. I said to my supervisor, I don't want to make her feel worse. That's what I thought letting people talk about their negative feelings did. Now, when I say that I was only allowed to paraphrase, she very forcefully said this to me. And it was clear that she meant it. And I went into that next session with that client sweating, thinking that I would sound ridiculous, that I would sound like a parrot just repeating what she said. But I found that when I was only paraphrasing, which is actually probably 90% of what I do in my work as a therapist, when I said, gosh, that sounds really overwhelming and like it's hard to have hope when you can't figure out what the next step is. When I paraphrased, instead of offering a solution or putting a positive spin on it, the client went deeper and deeper and deeper into her feelings. And the more she was able to share, the more space that was created for all that negativity that was living inside of her, the more relief she got to feel. That hour changed not only my mind about the skill of paraphrasing, which honestly I thought was total bullshit. It changed my mind about the power of the paraphrase and the power in feeling deeply seen and heard and understood. There's research that says that if somebody can offer another person 8 minutes of their time, just as an ear, it can make a world of difference in how somebody feels. Dr. Tia reiterates this throughout the podcast. If you listen back, you can hear her examples, and much of them are paraphrasing, you know, things that kids, teens might say. When I was in middle school, my parents divorced, and my mom and I moved from Michigan to Missouri. And inevitably, you know, new friends' parents would ask, "Oh, you're new here. Why did you move to St. Louis?" And I would, I didn't know how to lie, innocently say, "Well, my parents got divorced and my mom and I moved here." It was projected that my dad would be transferred in the next few years to either St. Louis or Kansas City. And we had some family in St. Louis, so we opted for St. Louis, thinking that either way, we would be close-ish. And every time that my friend's parents would ask me that question and I would tell them the truth that we moved here because of my parents' divorce, they would, every single time, get uncomfortable, change the subject, and I interpreted that as that I was too much, that there was something uncomfortable about me. There was something wrong with my situation. There was something about my situation that made people uncomfortable. Until I had a newish friend in eighth or ninth grade, and I remember going to lunch with her and her mom, who happened to be a therapist. And we were at Casa Gallardo, rest in peace, at Casa Gallardo. And her mom asked me the same question that everybody else did: "What brought you to St. Louis?" And I said, "My parents' divorce." And she said, "Oh, interesting. How did you feel about their divorce?" And I remember feeling so relieved that she could touch my situation and didn't need a 10-foot pole, that she didn't change the subject. I can still cry about it, just thinking of how I felt and the difference in how that felt compared to how other people would avoid my situation like the plague. And I think that was probably one of the first instances that deep conversations, hard conversations, people being willing to broach that line had me feeling really okay. She didn't try to fix it. She just was seeking to understand. And I think that a lot of us really underestimate the power of just seeking to understand and being a good listener. Okay, and Dr. Tia also talks about social media and what she believes are some really negative effects that social media is having on teens' mental health. I am hosting a workshop on May 7th where I'm going to spill all of the details. It's been very complicated to figure out over the years of how I manage technology in our household and family. I'm going to be giving you everything that we use, how to set it up. And I think technology is great, but how I think about it is I want my kids to have a 1980s relationship with technology. And when I was a kid, you couldn't watch TV all day long. At some point, the boring shows came on and we were forced to make our own fun. So I will be sharing, like I said, all of the details on how I do that is one way to do it on the 7th of May. And you are more than welcome to come. Just head to my website at micahross.com and click on workshops that are live or online, and you'll find that there. I have been using this app called OneSec for myself, and I'm getting ready to introduce it to my teens because of this interview, which I'm sure they will be thrilled with. But OneSec is an app that you can apply to almost anything, any app on your phone. I apply OneSec to Instagram, and it makes me take a deep breath and contemplate just for a few seconds why I'm opening this app, and then asks me again, "Are you sure you want to open Instagram?" And this helps me be more conscious of my social media and phone usage in general. And it has been so helpful in giving me some of my life back, because, you know, you open your phone and I sometimes my finger just is like on a mission and doing its own thing totally unconsciously, and I end up wasting a lot of minutes of my life. One sec helps us get those minutes back. So I have a link for you in the show notes, and I've reached out to them and they have so graciously shared. So check out One Sec. I hope it's so helpful in helping you and your teens manage your phone usage a little bit more. I hope that something about this was so helpful, y'all.